This is from Joel's book. God cannot give us life, and God cannot give us death. God is eternal life, and his life is the life of our being. He does not give it, he is it. If there were a God life and our life, God life might be immortal and ours mortal. But if God is infinite, God is infinite life, and that means your life and my life. You cannot have an immortal God who is infinite and any other kind of life. That is the fact. It doesn't change. And that is why in the meditation upon it, we simply rest in the knowledge that immortal life is the fact. It doesn't depend on whether you accept it or not. It is the fact. And therefore, you can never really claim mortality and be in truth. If you have a life that you think can begin and end, or can be tarnished by disease, infected by germs, a life that can have an unsuccessful business, you're talking about mortal life, mortality. You're not talking about life. Life is not any of those things. And the call to oneness comes to you once more, of one crying in the wilderness of your consciousness, saying, "Believe on me." The one that I am, you are. And drop your fears, drop your cares, drop all that is unlike the one, for there is no other. And stand defenseless in the knowledge that I am the one, and there is no power on this earth that can be used against the one that I am. The life of God is my life. The life of God is immortal. The life of God needs no protection, for there is only the life of God. All form is without life. All form is contained only in the consciousness that beholds it. There is nothing that form can give you or take away. You are self-complete divine life. This is fidelity to the truth that God being pure, God being the only cause, the only creator, all that can exist is that purity which I must be. This is your standard. All of the counterfeit will drop out of your experience. Those of you who are going to do healing work, ask yourself, what about this invalid you're supposed to heal? Where is that invalid? Somewhere out there? No, in your consciousness. Are you going to heal the invalid, or are you going to heal your consciousness? Those who have another kind of a thing that they want to improve, where is it? Out there? No. In your consciousness. How do you heal your consciousness? Rest in the truth that makes you free. Immortal life is one, indivisible, and there is no other. Anywhere. The condition has no existence except in false consciousness. Be still and know that I am immortal life. Be still and know that I am yourself. In all your travels, you'll never go outside of your consciousness. And if it is pure, aware only of the divinity of being, that is what you will experience wherever you go. Its qualities will express wherever you go. Now, if you're a team of two in this work, and one of you starts to talk about dualities, that's a chance for the one who's listening to say, wait a minute, how can that be true if you're the one life? We can catch each other very nicely and help each other that way. Every time you're thinking in terms of duality, that's the time for someone to say to you, wait a minute, if only divine life is, how can that be the truth? You're worrying about a mirage. Don't you have the courage of God's life to be your life? You don't have to take any steps. It is your life, and it's the life of everyone you know. Rest in that one life and watch how it's self-enforcing, self-revealing, self-fulfilling. The moment you step out of the images and rest in the one life, it fulfills itself. If there is anyone in your experience who is not the one life that you are, you're in duality. And you think there's another kind of life than the one indivisible, perfect, immortal life of God. That's the truth we learn to live with. I think we can rest now and come back to some of the quotations. Joel says, when we come to God aright, we have a God that we can love with all our heart and soul, because we can look upon this world with its injustices, sins and disasters, and be thankful that there is no God in any of the evils besetting mankind. God is not in the whirlwind. And he says there is no God in any of the evils besetting mankind. When we're told there's no God in an evil, and God is life, there's no life in an evil. Isn't that amazing that there can be no life in an evil? There can be a whole nation at war and there's no life in that evil. What can that possibly mean? Isn't that the nothingness of mortal form? If there's nothing, no life in a war, no life in the people carrying on the war. You see the momentity of the statement? We can be thankful that there is no God in any evil besetting mankind. He's also saying there's no mankind, let alone the evil. Because if somebody's going out there with a sword to gouge somebody, where is there no life? In just the sword? Or in the man about to do the gouging, or in the man about to get it? There's no life in any of it. You can't just take a little piece out and say, this is the part without the life. Do you see how the statement is veiled? There's no God in any evil besetting mankind. People would be willing to agree that God isn't in those evils. The medical profession, for example, would say, well, that's true, God isn't in this evil. But they won't go so far as to say, because God isn't in this evil, the evil isn't here. And we must go that far. Some of us must be prepared to demonstrate that it isn't here. In our own lives, in the lives of those around us, and whoever may come to you and say, I feel a light in you that can help me. There is no God in any evil. And this is the statement that evil is non-existent. When we have removed God from them, we have removed the substance from them. They begin to destroy themselves. They begin to dissolve. When you remove God from any evil, you have removed its substance. But how can you do that? How do you remove God from an evil? By the knowledge that God isn't in that evil, that it has no life. But can you say it has no life and still fear it? And still try to dodge it? And still try to overcome it? Or do you resist not? If it has no life, are you going to resist it and thereby believe it does have life? Now, what is an evil? Not just a horrible man making a face at us. An evil is a condition that is unlike God. Some condition that you would normally want to get rid of. And you find now through this revelation that there's nothing to get rid of except the belief that you have such an evil. Why? Because God isn't in the evil. God is in you as your life. The only reason that was evil to you is because you had not been in the consciousness that you are divine life. Not in the understanding of it mentally, but in the consciousness that you are divine life. And as divine life, you are infinite divine life. And where is the evil in infinite divine life? Look into your infinite divine consciousness. You can't find any evil there. But you can't look into your infinite divine consciousness until you are accepting yourself to be divine life. And then if you were Jesus Christ, you would look into your consciousness and you wouldn't see a cripple there. He just wouldn't be there. And you know he therefore isn't there. And lo and behold, he would walk. The moment you are divine life, you can remove the belief that God is in evil. And you can also remove the belief that evil is in you. The moment you're properly identified and faithful to identity, you have dissolved evil from your consciousness. Joel says, in the realization that God is our very being. Well, that's exactly where we've been up to now. Resting in the realization that God is our very being. How can we fear, love, or hate gold and silver? Germs, poisons, bullets, bombs. Now, you must remember, this was a man who appeared in the flesh making these statements. And you must remember that he had lived through the proof wherewith he could make these statements. Now, how could he have lived through the proof of that as flesh and blood? It was only in the realization of his self to be that self, which is yourself, which is divine self. And then he could say, because I am divine self, I have been able to prove that there is no power in these things. Divine self is the power. Now, you've had quite a number of experiences that prepare you for this trust you must have to take every extra step. If you hadn't had any spiritual experiences, you'd never have the trust or the confidence to explore spiritually. To be a spiritual pioneer, Spirit has already given you enough of an insight so that you're willing to move out just a little further than you are, and finally to that state of no defense. Just as you don't fear the cold germ, you learn not to fear anything else. Why? Because all power is in God, and God is present everywhere. And the only life present is the life of God. The moment you have a fear of a condition, you fear that the life of God isn't the only life present, beginning with yourself. The moment you fear for your child, you fear the life of God isn't there. But what are you looking at? An image in your consciousness, and you're mistaking it for your child. Your child is the image and likeness of God. God said so. Why deprive the child of its divine selfhood in your consciousness? And then why deprive yourself of your divine selfhood when the Father says you are the image and likeness? Why not look past your form and his form? For you know they are not the divine image and likeness, and I accept the divine image and likeness that is there, the one body in Christ. For we are all one body in Christ. In your oneness, you will find your perfect spiritual temple, which walks through fire, air, flood, earth, unharmed, which does not descend, which does not terminate. This is the purpose of our work, to attain that immortal selfhood, which is forever. And if we have to have a starting point of looking through evils, with the knowledge that only God is there, then we can be thankful that the evils appeared to us to challenge us, to goad us into being willing to be defenseless in the face of these things. For that will give us another experience, enabling us to step still higher. Just as all your spiritual experiences have brought you to this point of confidence, so will your future experiences do the same. All will lead you to that perfect temple, the soul body. How can we fear that God's being can be destroyed? We are the form, but God is the essence and the substance even of our bodies. And when I wrote this, copied this from Joel's book, I underlined even of our bodies, because he is telling you that this is not your body. You know God isn't the essence of this body. All you have to do is look at the doctor bills in your first 20 or 30 years, and you'll know God isn't the essence of this body. But if he says God is the essence of our bodies, he's telling us about a body that we definitely do have, and it's not the one you look at. Again, he's sliding in the truth that we are all one body in Christ. I know you wish he'd be more direct. Well, let's just say that Spirit speaks through him and has its reasons. And it's up to you and I to look with the discerning eye of the soul. God is the essence of our being, and in him there is no darkness. Therefore, in you there can be no darkness. Therefore, in that of which we are formed, there is no capacity for negative activity of any nature. All negative activity is the false consciousness which has not understood that there is no capacity for any lack or limitation in the essence of your being. It takes courage to withdraw from this false consciousness. And that's why we have those exercises that you're to take with you, because that's how you master your consciousness. It brings into your consciousness a form called disease. And you look at it and you expel that form from your consciousness. It brings into your consciousness a form called lack, and you expel that from your consciousness. You develop the spiritual muscle to do that. Why? Because it isn't true. This is the house of the Father. The essence of my being is God. There's no capacity for lack or limitation in God. I don't have to improve anything. I simply have to expel the false belief. Expel the mortal belief, and the immortal truth reveals itself. Always the immortal truth is present, though unseen. And the mortal sense of truth is not present, but is seen. When you expel what isn't, what is reveals itself. If we do not credit God with being pure, says Joel, how then can we be pure? We can be no more pure than our source, our essence, our substance. You see how you cannot claim any impurity in your life, because the moment you do, you're claiming two things. First, you're claiming God isn't pure. God isn't complete. And second, you're claiming that you are not the child of God. You are not the essence of God. You are not the life of God. You're claiming separation from God. You're claiming either God's impurity or God's impurity and your separation from God. Always, you're claiming what isn't true, namely that God is impure or that you're separated from God. Neither are true. The purity of God and the eternal oneness of your essence with God is the guarantee that all is perfect now. You're only fighting a false belief in your consciousness. That's all you're fighting. Never a real condition. You're fighting the belief that such a condition exists. And you can only know it by stepping back from the false condition, believing in your essence to be the life of God, and watching your immortal life reveal itself as the perfect qualities of God without opposite. So you really have a very significant principle to go by. It's bedrock. If there's no evil in God, says Joel, there's no evil at all. For God is the source of all creation. Now, to me, I don't mind telling you this truth right here that he just gave us has more importance to me than Medicare. You can live with this truth. And you'll find you don't have any bills to pay. And there's a progression to this. As it proves itself out, it infiltrates every facet of your life, not just your physical health. It moves you higher and into your next experience. If there is no evil in God, and we can all agree to that, there is no evil at all, because God is the only creator. We need only to look at any situation and realize there's no God in this. Of course, I'd like to suggest that we don't wait for the situation and then try to look at it, because then that's a moment too late. But when you meditate with a truth as vital as there's no evil in God, and so there's no evil at all, you'll find situations simply won't rise up that might have. This is the way you constantly solidify your consciousness of truth. That can become so tip-of-your-tongue knowledge that any situation that might come and present itself would readily be dissolved by your instant knowledge that there's no evil in God, and therefore there's no evil. The truth in consciousness can never externalize as evil. It's only the lie in consciousness that externalizes as evil. And if you banish the lie, then the truth will make itself known. There's no power to sustain this because there's no God in it. There's no law of God to maintain it. And there's no power but God. Of course, this is all true, but we must work with it, meditate with it, contemplate it, until it's not Joel saying it anymore, it's your consciousness saying it automatically. Joel says this removes idolatry. We didn't know we were in idolatry when we saw evil, but we had a false picture in the mind. You might call that then a graven image. This prevents us from loving, fearing, or hating that which has form. Now, I'm quite aware that most of us married something that has form and gave birth to something that has form and love that which has form. But look at the statement, this prevents us from loving, fearing, or hating that which has form. So he's telling you where that form is. It's in your consciousness. It's not out there. But something is out there. Don't think nothing is out there. Something is out there. Out there is the consciousness that is also making that form. And you fell in love with the consciousness. Your consciousness fell in love with that consciousness. And these two little images in the middle, they said, I do. The consciousness and the consciousness were being wedded into one consciousness. And that consciousness is still there. And as it becomes more and more aware of itself, and you become more and more aware of yourself, you'll find that Eve is going back into Adam's rib, and they are going to be one self in the invisible. One self. While you appear as two forms right here in the visible, or one is here and one is already going on, they are already one self in the invisible. That's the point. The life never goes on. The life that is showing forth in this form and in that form, that's the one life. It's never separated. There's no such thing as separation in the one life. And it doesn't matter if one is here or two are here. The one life is always indivisible. It does not depend on one form being here and one form being on another side of a veil. And when you have found the male and female consciousness that are truly one, they are always one. Always one. They're just sometimes on different cycles. We're learning not to love, hate, or fear the form, but we're learning to love the consciousness. The true consciousness. And to see that the form that we have been able to see with our human eyes is the product of that consciousness. And that consciousness is there. And it is real. And it is moving toward its oneness. And that is why there's always two moving to oneness to become one. There's no such thing as a half. Wherever you are, whoever you are, the other half is in consciousness. And always two are moving in oneness, even though they may not be doing so to the knowledge of both parties. Sometimes one has to catch up. One has to move on. Sometimes one has failed and has to move on to catch up that way, to return. But always there's one. When it's the one that is the eternal one, you know it. And so we come above form. It still dresses nicely. It's still selective about what it eats. It still goes to the best places. But it is seen to be a form within a larger consciousness which is showing forth that form. And we sow to the consciousness. And you can only do that by living in your consciousness. And more we're recognizing the perfection of the one divine life invisibly present. This is a hard statement, but it is an uplifting one when you have its significance and practice it. I don't think Joel makes a single statement anywhere that of itself is valuable unless you practice it. And so if you were to read, "Don't love, fear, or hate a form," it would be of no meaning to you until you have worked with it, until you have struggled to apply it. And then when you succeed in applying it, you can say, "Thank you, Joel, how grateful I am." Because no way could I have learned to look beyond the form, to see the higher self that is putting forth this form. And now I can love my neighbor, because the real consciousness of my neighbor, not the false one, not the false sense of human consciousness, but the real consciousness of my neighbor is divine. The real consciousness of my husband is divine. The real consciousness of my mother, brother, sister, child, wife is divine. And the form may not show it because there's a veil there, a human sense of consciousness. But you rest in the knowledge of that divine one consciousness, and it expresses. The Father who seeth in secret expresses. So here's Joel lifting us above the major trap, form. Because we know that the real essence of all form is God. Any erroneous form that may appear has no existence. He says, any erroneous form. Now, do you know of any form that isn't erroneous? Only the Christ form. The Moses form seen in the Transfiguration. When you take any form on earth, you find it's erroneous. And so what he's telling you is that form is erroneous, and to soften the blow so that those who cannot understand, he says, any erroneous form. If you're spiritually aware, you know he's saying that form is erroneous. Any erroneous form that may appear has no existence except in the belief in two powers. The powers of God are one. And where's the other power? And so the belief in two powers is the belief that there's another power beside God, or another cause beside God. And then you have erroneous form that you believe in, because God didn't cause the human form. God didn't cause the mongoloid. God didn't cause insanity. God didn't cause muscular dystrophy. God didn't cause the forms that are in these crippling diseases, or they wouldn't be in them. And God didn't cause any of the defects that we know. Who caused them? They have no cause. We suffer from defects without cause. They're only in the belief that there is a cause beside that cause, which is God. And when you remove that belief, when you learn there's no second cause, you say, what am I suffering from? I'm suffering from the belief that something caused this. But there's no cause. That means you're in the belief that you are a mortal being, that you're in a mortal life. And that's the only reason you believe there's another cause. There is no cause of mortal life. The only life is God. And when you come back to that house, the prodigal went out into mortal life. When you come back from that mortal life, that belief that you are in a mortal life, you're the prodigal returning to the knowledge of immortal life, returning to the Father. He went out into two-ness. He had to come back into one. There wasn't immortal life and mortal life. That was his mistake. That's the human race mistake. We have to come back into one. And in one, the only cause, the only power that can show forth is the power of the one. Behold, I, the power of the one. Only I can open your eyes. Only I can open your ears. Only I can make the crippled walk. Only the one can reveal that there is no second power on this earth to make pure divine form less than perfect. And that's you, pure divine form, seen through a glass darkly as a human image. Any erroneous form, and that's all human form, that may appear has no existence except in the belief in two powers, or except in the belief that God caused it. And so, is his conclusion. As human beings, we are living a life separate and apart from God. Make a correction. As human beings, we are living a life separate and apart from God, but not as mortal, immortal beings. The correction would be then, if I'm living a life separate and apart from God as a human being, and want to be in the oneness with God, I cannot be a human being. Because this is either a fact or it isn't. Merely by being a human being, we are apart from God. The human race, you might say then, is living separate and apart from God. Why? Because it doesn't know that it is divine life. And so it lives a human life, finite life. As long as we do that, there's certain to be some good and some evil. We have not grasped the meaning of omnipresence of God. We do not understand that where God is, I am. Where God is, Christ is. Where God is, your divine self is. Where God is, your immortal life is. And even though you cannot see it where God is, your immortal form is. That's what you learn to take on trust. Your immortal form is where you are. And wherever you go, your immortal form is. Because God is pure being and there is no other. Pure being is immortal, and there is no other. And you are immortal, and there is no other. If you love, hate, or fear the form, you believe it's there. And it isn't. That's the separation. That's a pretty stern beginning for a class, isn't it? Usually that's the end of a class. This is our beginning. What is not derived from God has no power. Know this, and then rest in his word, knowing that this has no rise in God. So every situation that is not perfect is not derived from God and has no real existence. You're being hypnotized to believe that a situation is real. Now you may think that your sense of reason clearly demonstrates to you that it's real, but that is based upon your belief that you are a mortal being. Take away the belief that you're a mortal being and you'll see the situation isn't real at all. It's a mortal situation. Remove the belief that you are a mortal being and you'll see that situation is impossible. That's why he says, this has no rise in God, no foundation in God, no law of God. Be not afraid. He can say it, but you must understand why he has said it. Be not afraid. Now here's how he ends, or how we do today anyway. What is a circle of Christhood except a circle of those who realize that evil does not have its rise in God, and therefore it has no law, no substance to sustain it? By abiding in that truth, they watch evil dissolve and disappear. So, to be in the circle of Christhood, we must develop the capacity to know evil does not begin in God, and therefore it has no beginning. Always, you come back to the fact that your mortal sense of life is all that has given birth to the appearance called evil. The moment you're not in the mortal sense, but have accepted the immortal reality of your being as immortal life, you can see evil begins to lose its meaning for you. It takes quite a bit of courage at first, vision, understanding, but you catch on. It begins to shred itself. It has nothing to stand on the moment you know you are immortal life. All of the evil had depended upon your mortal sense. When you begin to feel the immortal life of you, the evil is water off a duck's back. And you can translate that evil into many, many different forms. All of the negatives, all of the sufferings, all of the lacks. Paul told us somewhere, be not conformed to this world. He caught it. Don't be fooled by this world. Be transformed by the renewing of the mind. And we're renewing the consciousness. The new consciousness transforms your world into the divine image. That evil out there is in your false consciousness. That error, that lack, that limitation, that fear, everything that is not of God, that is out there, is not out there. It cannot be out there. It is in the false consciousness that bred it. The consciousness that is separated from the knowledge that I am immortal life. Now suppose you could accept God's word on that and begin there, that you are immortal life, and then make an inventory of what's wrong in your life and see whether God is right or you. Your inventory would be your way of denying what God says, that you are immortal life. And then make that a meditation. And see if you're not enlightened about whether God is right or your inventory of problems is right. And maybe you'll have a good clue that what you're suffering from is only the inability to accept what your mind does not fully understand. That you can only be divine life. There is no other. In that knowledge, you will say, nothing is impossible. Nothing. Because divine life is omnipotent. And that means putting no ceilings in your life. No place where you have to stop and say, I can't go beyond that. Infinity isn't that way at all. We're going to still stay on the chapter Pure Being one more time. There's a few more things in it, and we'll go on, though, to chapter 8 in John. So we'll continue in Pure Being next time, first chapter of Realization, and we'll do chapter 8, or part of it, in John. But I expect to see in your faces next time that you have caught some measure of holding the outer forms out there, which are not to love, hate, or fear, in your consciousness, and seeing that that's the only place they are as forms. Be kind of silly hating and loving and fearing something that's only in your consciousness. When you can feel the world out there as not external to you, but in your consciousness, you'll understand how dominion is going to come about. Could we have a moment of silence as an ending today? Suppose we all join in one life as the only presence, one immortal life. There no longer is that one voice speaking in a wilderness. It's speaking where there are those who are listening. In case you haven't quite caught it, you have been learning that you have no human life. And when you finally agree, you can't go on living only a human life if you don't have one. Because that would be a second life. And that's the cause of every problem on the earth. Thanks very much.